a little problem that I want to take care of, I've just never taken care of. That is, when I tune up, I've got a dual 20 amp circuit breaker in the panel. And if I key down for more than 10 or 15 seconds loading up, it's a nuisance. I pop the breaker. It's a 20 amp, 220 volt breaker. I want to put a heavier breaker in there. The electrician who wired that circuit wisely put in number 10, not number 12, three wire, number 10 DX cable. Do you or anybody know, can I go to as big as 30 amp breaker on number 10, or can I only go to number 25 amp on number 10, what the code is, and change the outlet to a 30 amp outlet and pop a 30 amp breaker in. Anybody know about what that should cost? The other question, Vic, I want to change the AC cord on the amp to something heavier. Do they make a 30 amp air conditioning extension cable? That would be a handy cable. I could cut one side off and wire it into the amp. It would give you a nice molded plug. Pretty straightforward question. Back to that.
Okay, you've got an answer on that particular one, Joe. Go ahead and wait for the beep, Joe.
No, I was just going to ask you if you can ask KE2EJ to connect this repeater back to the reflective 9126 and bring everything back online. You're not on it right now.
KE2EJ, we don't have connection to the 147.375 repeater, if you happen to be listening to us. Back up a little bit here, Rich. 20 amps of 220 volts is around 4,500 watts. What machine are you running that draws that much power?
No, I've got that two-tube amplifier, Vic.
Okay. When it comes to how much current you can put through what gauge of wire, when it comes to the pure physics of what you can do with the cable in the conduit, the wire table on the back of the Radio Amateur's Handbook is a very good reference. When it comes to the code, the next question you're really asking is 10-gauge wire, according to either the codes used in New York City or out here on Long Island, what is the maximum current you're allowed to put through 10-gauge wire? What if someone within the sound of my voice happens to have that piece of information? Please give us your call letters and name right now.
WS2NDP.
Okay, we had Paul and Steve in that order. Paul first, go ahead, Paul. And tell us what your second subject is going to be, Paul, while you're on the air. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good, by the way. Yeah. Number 10, why I show 30 amps. Second subject would be a little bit on the space program. They have a competition going out in Edwards Air Force Base about these space elevators. We could always talk about that this weekend. If he had a number 8 wire in there, I'd show 40 amps, but 30 amps, that's what he's looking for. So number 10 is good for that. Number 12 is good for 20 amps. So there you go. They also recommend like individual appliances, you know, for 30 and 40. In other words, that 10 amp, that 10 gauge wire should just be going to the amplifier. Shouldn't really be going anywhere else and splitting up. You know, it's not supposed to be running lights or air conditioners or something. Run one 10, number 10 directly to the piece of equipment, and they should, you know, you could run 30 amps. And that's according to basic wiring technique book by Orthro. Back to you.
Yeah, that's where it goes. It just goes to the 1 amp.
While you're at it, Paul, you told us 30 amps, 10 gauge, 20 amps, 12 gauge. What current is 14 gauge good for? Is it approximately 15 amps? Go ahead.
Yeah, QSL. Yeah, 14 is 15 amps. They have the numbers from board, you know, all the way up to 18. So 14 would be 15 amps here, Dick.
comment, K2KEY.
Well recognized. What gauge wire is used in Cat 5? Because Category 5 cable, which carries a lot of data around a lot of buildings, is starting to be used for PoE, power over Ethernet. I am guessing, but I'm not sure, that maybe that is a 20 or 22 gauge wire. You might know what gauge Cat 5 cable is and what current it's rated for. Over to you if you happen to know that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
24 gauge to KC2QIQ.
I was going to say, I don't have it listed yet, but around there.
And does your book for power wiring probably doesn't go up to 24 gauge, therefore it doesn't rate the current. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, I go to 18 gauge, 7 amps on that, and I go all the way the other way to number 4, which is, 195 you can do on that. That's a heavy-duty cable.
Yeah, that's the kind of cable I like to use for jumpers on my automobile. Let's see, in the order we have Steve and Mel. Steve, you wanted to add a comment to all of this? You got it, Steve, KC2MDP.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, the other gentleman is correct. Yeah, 30 amp, no problem, number 10 wire. What he could do, I would imagine this is probably two hot legs in a ground. Either look for a 30 amp range cord, a 30 amp range receptacle, or if he can't find that, he could use a dryer cord or a dryer receptacle. Now he's not going to find any more 3-wire dryer receptacles. Code now is you got to use a 4-wire, so he could use the hot, you know, the two hot legs and the green and ground. You know, it's already got the molded plug on it. You can get him 6-foot length. So you know, that should suffice for him. Back to you, Dick.
KC2WAD.
Okay, you're going to have to stand by there, Ralph. We've got three people ahead of you. I used to be able to buy the socket, receptacle, the cord, whatever, for dryers and things like that in my local hardware store. Three-prong type things, heavy-duty. I think you're saying three connectors are no longer code. It's all got to be 4 connector now. Is that what you're saying, Steve? Go ahead.
Yes, that is correct, Dick. The old dryers were basically two hot and a neutral, and you combined the ground wrapped in there, so the neutral and the ground combined with the dryer. Today, they want the neutral and the ground separate, so it's a four-wire receptacle on a four-wire cord today. Thank you.
Steve, your signal is unusually noisy. Are you at your normal location putting out normal power? Maybe your transmitter is not putting out the normal amount of power. You're just barely above threshold. Back to you, Steve.
Well, I'm at my normal location, but I'm in the backyard on an HG, you know, enjoying the nice weather while I can. Back to you.
KC2QIQ.
That explains it, because the handy-talkie, when you move it around for stronger signal and reception, it is not the best location for stronger signal and transmission. And Glenn recognized, Mel was the next person in the list. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I got, going up to my ham shack, I got number 8 wire. And down at the panel, you know, it's funny, when I was contemplating putting that in years ago, I was talking to one of these transmitters, the guys that were really working on some of the big equipment. This one guy, I know he was really involved with a number of big commercial transmitters and all. And he says the feed for it, your system, he says, be smart. He says, put in a panel with cartridge fuses. I says, are you kidding me? This day and age, not putting circuit breakers? He says, the damn circuit breakers start to heat up and they'll trip on you for no reason. There's no shortage of chipset. Even though they're rated, he says, sufficiently, he says you'll find that you'll have less trips from for no reason if you put in cartridge fuses, Dick. And you know something? I don't have any problem with the cartridge fuses. Over.
That's exactly parallel with my experience, Mel. I have a house built in 1956, which fuses in the main fuse panel. And I've since made modifications to portions of it. So I have circuit breakers in some places and old cartridge fuses in others. The old cartridge fuses have never given me a problem. The circuit breakers periodically have to be replaced because they start creating false alarms, false trips. So, and for anybody within the sound of my voice, know this. It's extremely tempting to use a circuit breaker switch as an on-off switch for power control. You should not do that. Very convenient, very obvious to just flip the switch when you want to kill the power. However, that circuit breaker and its contacts opening and closing are made for a finite number of openings and closures. Beyond that, it will become unreliable. It's not made to be used as a switch. Even though, yes, it will interrupt the power as if somebody had automatically flipped a switch when a fault is occurring. But you should not use it as a switch. We all do that. But know that you're using up the life of the circuit breaker when you do that. Glenn was the next person on the line. It was Ralph. Here we go. Yeah, it is Ralph. KC2, WAD is going to get it next. Ralph is a large net of people here, so be a little bit more brief, please. KC2, WAD, K2RAW.
Okay. Okay, I heard the beep. KC2, WAD. Yeah, so I agree. It's because nobody answered the CAT 4-5 question on the amps. So, 10 is 30 amps, 12 is 20, da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, I calculated down. I don't have a chart, but I've got 22 gauge is 6, 24 gauge, it's either 2 or 4 amperes. So the Cat 4, Cat 5 wire should be able to, a pair, should be able to handle 2 to 4 amperes. That's all. All right, we'll get back to the RC planes some other evening. Everybody have a good evening. I'm done. This is KC2, Whiskey Alpha Delta. Have a good night.
Very fine, Ralph. This TechNet does run for another couple of hours, so once we get off this particular subject, if no one else has any questions, we can go back to RC, and you're able to stay up a little bit later. Glenn, I know that you've been doing quite a few experiments and actually generating hardware that creates the power supplies for power over Ethernet, so that Cat5 cable is being powered by circuits that you are involved in the design of. And I presume the 2 or 4 amperes that that Ralph just mentioned to us, I know that you guys are a lot more conservative than that, and I think part of the reason is that it's a bundle of 4 pairs, total of 8 wires that are in a Cat5, and because of all the local heating and not a real conduit that it goes in, I guess there's a number of reasons why you don't push the wire to the maximum. On top of that, I think you want to use the wire for 100 meter length or something like that, and therefore the total voltage drop is something else that's got to be considered. KC2QIQ for some information on all of the above. K2RAW on the TechNet. You got it, Glenn. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Right on the money with that. Because basically in a Cat5, you've got 8 wires in there. You've got 4 pairs. And if you're going to start using, current inside, in DC power across a couple of those wires, it's typically limited to like around between 800 and 850 milliamps per wire. So each pair of wires are going to share, that 850 milliamps, and then, of course, you can build up the current by using multiple pairs. But because the wires are bundled, and the other thing that sometimes a little confusing when you're looking at current in wire is the length of the wire. Because when you can have buildings where there's Cat5 wire, run through the walls up to feet in lengths of 2,000 feet, and so typically you don't want to use much more than 800 milliamps through your Cat5 wire. There again, if it was a shorter, just a small jumper cable, you could probably get away with a little bit more, like the other gentleman that said, a few amps through it, but. Typically for the industrial application of power over Ethernet, nobody's really using more than 800 milliamps per wire on 24 gauge. Just one other thing, there was a mentioning about power cords, 3-wire power cords. Last time I was in the Home Depot, they still had some very, very heavy-duty gauge, looks like dryer type of, or oven, 3-wire plugs and cables. you know, the pre-wired, pre-molded cables up to, I think, like 6 foot lengths. So if anybody still needs them, they are still in Home Depot. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Good information, Glenn. If I was running 850 milliamps in my Cat 5 cable, from your point of view, what's the maximum number of feet or meters of length that I could do that over? And if my electric, and I think your university told me before that the maximum voltage that's used on power over Ethernet is 56 volts between a pair, plus or minus 56 volts total differential between the two. And I guess that implies one is ground and the other is plus 56, so to speak. I don't think you use minus 20, 23 and plus 23. But you might give me an answer on that one. But what's the maximum number of feet? And if my electronics had built-in regulation such that it could tolerate a much smaller voltage, like maybe I only need 10 volts, and I'm starting off with 56, could I therefore run 2,000 feet of that? I bet you there's a rules of thumb along these lines. KC2QIQ, the man who's there with POE, K2RIW, you got it, Glenn.
Well, so far the story with PoE is the limiting factor isn't so much the power, it's the data. Right now what everybody seems to want to do with Cat5 wire is run, gigabit data. You know, before, you know, local networks used to run on 10 megabits per second, then they went to 100, and now everything is, you know, is gigabit, you know, 1,000 megabits per second. So in those, with those kinds of data numbers, they limit the length of the wire to 2,000 feet, because anything longer than 2,000, you start really having some data problems with gigabit. So the PoE standards are actually basically being used with data, so they typically limit it to the 2,000-foot mark. 56 volts being the maximum voltage was kind of determined because you have to put data on top of the DC voltage, so it limits you to, you know, like 4 volts of peak data that you can write up on top of the 56, and the magic number is 60, because this, all of the safety agencies have basically looked at 60 volts as being the highest voltage that you can really touch. Anything more than that, then you're looking at problems with electrical shock hazard. So 60 volts being the maximum, and for touching, and 56 basically for operating, just to give you the headroom to run the data on top. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Very good information, Glenn. Now, when I was scanning the, what's the name of the company that makes zillions of kind of Belden? I was scanning the Belden catalog one day, came across the fact that everybody's using Category 5 cable, but they had something called Cat 6E cable. Category 6E, as I remember. And when you, and I got a sample of that stuff, and there was a fancy piece of molded plastic holding the four twisted pair in a very characteristic pattern, much more controlled in the impedance between the wires, and much higher quality of plastic, which probably has a much lower loss tangent to it. I wonder if you're familiar with Cat 6E cable. What kind of data rates are run through it, and what kind of lengths can I do power over Ethernet with high-speed data with Cat6 cable? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I guess it's kind of an interesting thing, what's happening with the standards today, is that basically the gigabit should work with just regular Cat5. I think there are still some issues as far as software goes and driving a lot of these systems, but the hardware typically can use the, use just regular Cat5. Cat5e is basically what they do is they weave and locate the wires and twist them in such a way that basically they give the optimum performance. So I guess if people are concerned about, you know, running very, very long lengths to 2,000 feet, which is the maximum standard, you know, that basically you're getting the best performance of the wire. But there again, you know, it should be able to operate just as well with the Cat5. But here again, I have heard situations where people have gotten stuck with certain systems with links even in, you know, 300, 400 feet in certain systems where they just, you know, are having, you know, lost data and a lot of error correction taking over and slowing the whole system down to where they've gone to the Cat5e, and it's made some improvements. But other than that, here again. I think the gigabit arena right now for networks is still in its early stages, and as the software programmers get better and writing those algorithms better, the reliability and the speed of the systems will certainly improve.
If I've got more, let me drop. If I've got need for a higher data rate than 1 gigabit per second, I can use the other pairs of wire in the cable. And
welcome to the New England Reflector, 912,
Channel 6.
By the way, you blew everybody off about a half hour ago.
Clint, you with the comment?
Okay, Alex recognized. And if I want to run higher speed data, I can do it by using other pairs. And run a gigabit from each pair. And if I got 4, I guess I could run a total of 4 gigabits in theory. And I know of various people who would like to run data at rates of around 3.5 gigabits these days. So when it comes back to you, Glenn, I'm going to be asking you questions about that. Alex is going to give us some information. Into NNU, the man from Yonkers, K2RIW. You got it, Alex.
Yeah, hello, guys. The 2,000 feet limit for the gigabit is presuming that you do not have splices on the cable. Once you have hops and whatnot on the cable, the length of the connection is shortening drastically. Practical, you cannot run a 1 gigabit link or more than, say, 400 or 500 feet. No, sorry. 200 feet on a practical basis. This is why the power supplies are now made much smaller, not 56, but 48 volts. Those are common voltages. Also, every unit now has their own SMPS switching mode power supply that will drop the 48 volts to whatever is needed into the box. So that's what I wanted to add to think back to you.
Very good. Search and mode power supply, SMPS. That's what we need is more acronyms, Alex. We don't have enough acronyms. Got to add some more. You apparently believe in UAA. I sometimes ask my friends I work with, do you believe in UAA? And they say, what's that? That stands for, it equals use all acronyms, UAA. I've seen people write memos where multiple sentences consist of tremendous numbers of acronyms with very few ands and twos in between, very little other information. Is that obviously the highest way to get data is fiber optic, but fiber optics is a hell of a lot more expensive. When people are pulling cables throughout the drop ceiling of a building, Cat 5 cable I think is done 99% of the time, and occasionally fiber. Too bad there's no good way of sending power over fiber. Although someday somebody may invent a way of doing that one. But if I want to go beyond 1 gigabit per second, if I've only got 200 feet to go, 63 meters, so to speak, is there a better cable other than fiber optic I could be using, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Use coax.
Actually, that's an interesting statement, coax. I've got a lot to say with that. Coax is like, kind of like a DSL system. And people who use DSL can kind of tell you where that's at. It's not the greatest in the world. Cat 5, 2,000 feet. And let me tell you that there are people definitely going 2,000 feet in gigabit and above. There's a company, don't want to mention their names and things, but they're doing full video telecommunications, and they're selling it. And they're running 2,000-foot lengths through POEs, hubs, splitters, the whole nine yards. They're running everything, and they're doing it. So, I mean, it's not like it's in the future. It's actually available today. They're expensive systems. They're business systems, but it is for worldwide communications. Now, when you're getting to the street level, in other words, now you're going outside the building, you go into your modulator hub, and now you go up onto fiber optic, and now you go miles, hundreds of miles going through your fiber optic. So the 2,000-foot mark, that should take care of you and all your inter-wiring through your building, through your hubs, through nodes, all the other good stuff. And then when you get out to the street level, boom, you're on fiber optic, and now you can go miles and miles and miles, get your signal to wherever you want to go, and you're doing it broadband, multi-gigabit, and it all works. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, I thought that over the 200 feet you need a repeater, no more a hop. There are two different here, two different animals, the passive and the active one. I thought over the 200 feet you need the repeater.
You are currently connected to reflector 9.
I mean 200 feet, not 2,000 feet, 200 feet.
You are currently connected to reflector 9126.
Do I have it, or...?
You've got it, Glenn, and it looks to me like we've timed out the eastern repeater again. We didn't wait for the beeps.
Okay, just quickly, Alex, right now, the systems that will run through hubs and everything else at 2,000 feet, they're doing it. I mean, it's basically being done. There are definitely issues with some of the systems, with software and other things that make it's not an easy task. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of the firmware and software designers, and I can tell you, they've got to run these long lengths and go through all the testing that they do to prove these systems out. It's a hair puller. The lengths that you're talking about, like, you know, 200 feet, that's typically like your DSL stuff and running coax. When you get to 200 feet with coax, that's where those kinds of problems are. But right now with the Ethernet and the gigabit, it's moving along. I mean, they're really not having those kinds of problems. Let me pass back to Dick first, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I've recently done some study of what happens when you do splicing on a cable of known characteristic impedance. And if you're smart enough in the way you do the splice, such that you do not create any loading, if there's a field effect high impedance transistor doing the sampling at the point of splice, you can put T-connectors all over the place without disturbing the impedance. So if you're smart enough, in my opinion, you can put taps in a line. So I guess I've got two questions or three questions here for you, Glenn. I am guessing that the twisted pair within a Cat5 cable are either 90 or 100 ohm impedance. If I maintain that carefully throughout the system, I think you're saying I can go as far as 2,000 feet with reasonable integrity of the data at a 1 gigabit rate. I presume if I'm only running 200 feet instead of 2,000 feet, and if I'm careful enough, with control of impedance, I might be able to go to a higher data rate than 2 gigabits per second. So give me a couple of confirmations on some of those speculations. Is it 90 or 100 ohm impedance on the twisted pair first? Back to you, Glenn. K2RIW in the tech net.
There's different systems use different, and certain cables have a slightly different characteristic impedance. Most of them range between 100 to 200 ohms, typically. You kind of have to look at that if you're really, really pushing the limits on what you're doing with that. But here again, it shouldn't be that big a difference whether you're using the 100 ohm or the 200 ohm characteristic impedance, because basically as long as the drivers are good and the receivers are good on the other end, on your TX-RX, it should be able to decipher it. The quality of the signal that comes down the other end really depends on the electronics on both sides. Better drivers, transceivers that you have on either end, they're going to make all the difference in the world. The other thing is keep in mind character sets and how they're sent in software. If you send certain characters in repetition, they can go down the cable and be recognized very, very easily. There are certain characters when you send them back to back, down a codec, and they explode down the cable, on the other side, the system can get confused. And then, of course, the error correction comes in, and the system has to, go back, read it again, and think about it, and that slows down the system. But typically, depending on how the software is done, and the transceiver on the other side is getting a code that it can decipher clearly in strings, then you can move along really, really quick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Other comment.
Okay. Yeah, I've got some further questions, but let's go over to Alex first. N2NNU, you got it, Alex. I'll wait for the beep.
Okay, drop two. Well, at those speeds, you are not talking anymore about bit-by-bit translation. You're talking about symbol translation. You're talking a very sophisticated sort of modulation, which is called a trellis. And the more points in the trellis, the more symbol per bit you can put in. So while we think we send one bit of information, we can send up to 32 or even 64 bits of information per this point in the trellis. So it is important to remember that the modulation has something to do with the speed of transmission. When we say gigabit is total transmission of data, but on the line it might go much, much slower. Back to you, Dick.
I agree. As long as you've got a high enough signal-to-noise ratio, where you can use things like 16 QAM, 64 QAM, trellis, whatever, the various more exotic modulation techniques, you can get a larger and larger number of bits per symbol that's transmitted, and therefore the data rates can start increasing. But again, you've got to maintain the signal-to-noise ratio in order for that to have a reasonable bit error rate, BER. Now, one of the things that I did about 5 or so years ago, I was on a particular project that needed this information. I took ordinary Grut Cat5 cable, I don't think it was Cat5E, and I carefully measured the impedance of the four data pairs. And I seem to remember it came out somewhere between 100 and 110 ohms of characteristic impedance for Belden brand of Cat5 cable. Where you said that sometimes the impedance is used at 200, I'm a bit amazed by that one, Glenn. Now, I mean, you could make a TXRX that is designed for 200, but I think ordinary Cat5 cable does not go there. I think the cable itself is very close to 100 or 110, as I think is the range. In fact, if I actually looked at the specs out of the Belden catalog, I think they called it 100 plus or minus 5 or something along those lines. So where the 200 number came from with ordinary cable is a bit amazing to me. And maybe you've got some comments on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ with a delay, K2YYW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. That's absolutely correct. In other words, the 100 ohm is one standard, you know, which is standard, like Cat5 cable, is 100 ohms with a tolerance. But look very carefully through that catalog again, and you'll find that there are other types of cables, like these numbers E's on the end and other things that will go there, and the characteristic impedance of them is different. It's not 100 ohm. It's 200 ohm. And you can look at that, and that's actually for different applications. I'm not the expert in, you know, which is better, the 200. I believe the higher impedance is supposed to be better for the higher transmission rate, but don't hold me to that one. I'm not really sure. But I do know, I am aware that that Cat5 cables come in two different types of impedances. You have the 100 ohm impedance set. You know, this is not resistance of the wire. This is the characteristic impedance, like, you know, looking down like a coax lead or whatever. It's the characteristic impedance is could either be 100 or 200 ohms, depending on the standard of the cable that you're buying. So when you look at it, when most people just get a standard reel of Cat5, it usually is the 100, though. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Short history.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
I believe the 200 ohm cable has been invented by DataPoint. DataPoint has been the true inventor of the ARCNET type of networking. This was their very first beginning, and ARCNET is a very solid, very good networking system. Their problem was that they kept it too close to their shirt, and they didn't want to expose it to other people, so they wanted the whole market, and they lost it all. So along comes IBM with twisted pair and all of that crap, and that rift the history. But going back to DataPoint, until then, DataPoint were using coax cable, so you had to have an active repeater here and there where you needed a splice. That was quite expensive, and the trust was now to put in a high impedance system of wires. So they devised that two parallel wires in a cable that had a 200 ohm impedance and a very high impedance driver into the hubs. And now suddenly they were able to tap serially without interrupt the wire. If you remember, the very first networks were coming from IBM, they needed a closet with relays. When you take out a cartridge, you will not lose the whole network. And that was going away with the invention of that high-impedance cable and the high-impedance drivers. This is part of the history. Back to you.
Interesting. We've come a long way. My guess is, Glenn, that 99% of all the Cat5 cable installed is 100 ohm cable. I wonder, have you seen 200 ohm cable? The way you make the impedance of twisted pair higher is to have a thicker insulation and a greater spacing distance between the wires, either smaller diameter wire at the same spacing or same diameter wire with a larger spacing, and you'll go to 200 ohms. But my guess is that would have a very characteristic view when you slice the cable off and look down the end of it. So I'm guessing that the 200 ohm cable is reasonably rare stuff. But that's question number one. Have you seen it? Would I easily recognize it as being different? Does the outside say something that would tell me that? Second of all, when it comes to the standard for how the RG45, I think it's called, connector, that's put on the end, at the color coding of the wires going into that connector, I vaguely remember there were two separate standards. You might give us a couple of words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not the expert on the color codes either. If I need to know them, I usually look them up inside, you know, look them up inside a book. But the wiring of all Cat5 is the same. In other words, your 1 through 8 across your connector pins are the same, and the cable can be reversed in either direction. So in other words, if you take one end, plug it in, go to the other end, it always has to be wired end to end exactly the same way. The color codes I'm not really sure on. My best advice for somebody is if you have to wire one of those connectors, go get the, you know, the standard book, look at it. As a matter of fact, I think it's even available on the internet. You can find it in certain spots. If you look up Cat5 cable, probably even in Wikipedia, it might give you those color codes if you have to get them. The other question was, is 200 ohm available? Yeah, it's around. I mean, I've seen it. I'm not sure. You know, I know it is. They have it where I work, but where they actually purchased it from and how it got there and how available it is, I'm not really sure. It looks basically just like the other, but there is a marking on it that will tell you. And in the short patch lengths, a lot of times that I've used, I haven't really noticed too much of a difference in the performance between the two. I guess it's when you start getting up to those 2,000-foot mark, you know, where you're really doing the data pings and you're trying to make sure, you know, exactly how much data is really going down the line. That's where it becomes much more important. The thing that I've actually found, I know you didn't ask this question, but it's kind of an interesting thing to mention, is that there is Cat5 cable that is shielded. It has a fully encapsulated shield that goes around the outside, goes out to the Cat5 connector, and actually has the grounding ring around the outside of the 810 connector. That is a very neat thing to have. In many, many cases, that can save an awful lot of trouble as far as interference goes. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I presume the major reason for that, I'm going to call it a shielded foil on the outside of the cable. I presume it's to not pick up extraneous noise that's along the, let's say, 2,000-foot length. If I had to run Cat5 cable past some really high-current machinery, for instance, a punch machine or a milling machine or something like that, where interference could be picked up, I presume that's where I would be motivated to use the shielded versions of Cat5. And I presume there's a characteristic marking on the outside telling me that. Also, my other question, Glenn, is that where you've seen 200 ohm Cat5 light cable, have you actually looked down the end of it? Do the wires themselves and the insulation between them look different to your memory? Back to you, Glenn.
I would like to ask Glenn something, too.
Let me answer Dick first. I haven't really opened up the cables too much and really started, you know, evaluating them, because I really don't have too much to do as far as that end is concerned. But shielded cable, one of the main reasons I've seen it being used isn't because of outside interference getting in and basically causing the problem, because most of the time, once the system is set up well and everything's working properly, they're pretty darn immune to a lot of things on the outside. You'd be surprised how immune they are to outside interference. As a matter of fact, usually most of the equipment has to withstand 10 volts per meter as far as susceptibility goes. So, I mean, these systems are usually pretty darn good. But the shielded cable is actually for the opposite reason. A lot of these digital circuits, and they're noisy, Dick. They're some of the best EMI generators you can think of. And you can imagine, if you've got a lot of data lines running through the wall, around the house, through the back of the facility, a lot of hub connections, and a lot of patch cords going in and out, how much noise can actually come off of these, off of all these interconnects. And by putting replacing them with shielded cable can drop the ambient noise in an office area quite a bit. Let me pass it back to you, Dick, and then maybe we can pick up Alex's question. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
K2RAW. Eric recognized. So it's going to be Alex and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Alex.
Thank you, Dick. Glenn, I always wanted to find out this information, but I never found the proper place where to. Assuming that 2 gigabit nodes are connected together and one is transmitting continuously 1 0s, 1 0s, 1 0s. Okay. Need anybody take a look on the wire to see what is the center frequency of that, make FFT analysis? That will tell us a lot about the cable and everything else. Did you have an opportunity to do that?
I've seen the reports that actually have that information, Alex. And what I'll do is, I promise you, I will look at it and I will see. Next, I'll get a copy of it and try see if I can get you that information. What happens most of the time when this stuff gets tested for, you know, throughput data, we actually go to like places and that will actually run these tests and tell us the overall performance of our boxes and our throughput per data, you know, because basically we're doing the power end, and the data throughput is usually coming from, from other sources. But I have seen the reports, and that information is in there. And what I'll do is I'll try to take a look at it and get back to you on that.
I really appreciate that. Most of the people I asked, they told me that this is private information. They cannot tell us or whatever. Okay, thank you so much. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, that would be kind of interesting to see the spectral display of what the data really looks like on the cable. You've got it, Eric.
Yeah, well, you asked the question of what's the difference in the wiring. The wiring, one is the 568A and 568B. One is a reversing cable, one is not. You guys also didn't talk about the twist, that the twist actually occur at different rates. Nobody really mentions what the signals are that passes through the cable. Not one might think that it's a serial DC that goes on and off, except that there's actually a couple different formats. Also, when you're talking about gigabit Ethernet, the maximum length is supposedly 25 meters. I've never in my life seen 200 ohm cable. I'm not doubting that it exists, but the specifications for all Ethernet adapters that I've ever seen is 100 ohms. And there's the noise immunity from the different twists is one issue. And I've seen a foil shielded Ethernet cable, but there's really no place to ground it. And there's an interesting technique that some of the broadcasters use this stuff. So when you finally get to gigabit Ethernet, you're actually talking about trellis. Remember that thing, trellis, that we used to talk about? Well, anyway, they call it trellis-coded modulation. And the rest of the stuff is PAM. So, like 100 base T is really 125 megabaud. 10 base T is really 15 megabaud. The non-gigabit stuff is only three-level signaling. The gigabit stuff is, depending upon what format you're using, is either 8 or 10-bit symbol. So, there you go. Back to you, Dick. K2RAW, K2J.
I missed one word. Did you call it trellis-based modulation? Go ahead.
It's called trellis
encoded modulation. Trellis coded modulation. Okay. That'll help us look it up. The twisted pair, if it's done correctly, and by the way, anybody who's ever taken apart Cat 5 cable and looked at it carefully will recognize that the four pairs of cables have four different twist rates. The reason for that is to make sure that very little coupling occurs between adjacent pairs. If they had the exact same twist rate and they laid parallel for a long period of time, there would be data coupling. Of course, the twist rates are different. The isolation is quite significant. When you look at a twisted pair, just like when we used to look at 300 ohm twin lead, to a person who is very coaxial cable oriented, it looks like an open, unshielded structure. As long as the spacing between the two wires of a twisted pair is short enough in wavelength, the radiation from it is very little. That twisted pair is an extremely well-shielded cable for the wavelength we use it at. And we're saying, Glenn, that the radiation from the cable can be significant. I think it's because people are misusing the cable in some way. They put common mode modulation on it as opposed to using it as pure differential. If it was used as a pure differential data set, I'll bet you the radiation from that cable is only a few dB worse than a piece of coaxial cable of approximately the same diameter. That's my guess, braided coaxial cable. It's reasonably well shielded. By the same token, the three-phase wiring that you got for your 100 kilovolt power transmission system, 60 cycle power transmission systems, it looks like very open wiring. Those three wires for the phase A, B, and C throughout, not necessarily distribution, but certainly for transmission. Let me drop. Those three wires have a very specific spacing between them. And at a 60 hertz rate, where the wavelength is a zillion meters, so to speak, that's a very well-shielded system. The amount of magnetic field that comes off there, even though 1,000 amperes or 5,000 amperes is flowing down each one of those wires, there's very little magnetic field coming off there. Very little E field. So, are you sure, Glenn, that the properly used twisted pairs within Cat 5 really radiates that much? In which case, I think you're talking about an extremely sensitive system. You're not going to get the screaming transmitter signals as if they're coming off an antenna, coming off the Cat 5 cable, if the cable is properly used. Now there we've got a little bit of a problem. If I used it as a unbalanced twisted pair, I will admit it's going to radiate a lot more than if I used it as pure differential data. And for all I know, the pure differential data sets, similar to what used to be called a 1553 data bus military systems, maybe that's the more rare and almost unused data protocol. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think there's a certain amount of validity to what you're saying. In other words, if you look at everything in a perfect world, if everything's up on the same powered point, everything's all in one simple loop of connections, and everything's sitting up on one isolated table, I think that what you're saying is valid. Where the problem comes in many of these networking systems, is you have a device that's plugged into a wall in room A. A cable goes through the wall, goes into another device in another room, plugged into another wall, into another outlet. And you have all these connections. You have hubs in between that might be running off of an isolated wall wart. You might have all of these items that are interconnected, peripherals that are connected up to this device. I mean, there's so many things you can put on Ethernet. And eventually what happens is switch boxes themselves, and each one of these individual items, if you measure them in an anechoic chamber for EMI, and, you know, you'll see that, yeah, those levels are down below, 20 dB microvolts. They're at 10 meters. You know, it's a very, very, you know, nice low signal. Now what happens is when you start interconnecting them and putting them on dissimilar grounds and in different places and running wires all over the place, all of a sudden the noise floor, you're not at 20 dB microvolts anymore, if that makes a little bit more sense of putting it in perspective. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Gentle reminder. Okay, with all of those, Alex recognized, with all of those interconnections in the various rooms, is that a daisy chain system, or is that being properly
interconnects. Over to you, Glenn.
I would say that they're properly matched. In other words, when they go from room to room or device to device, peripheral to peripheral, in other words, it's basically, you know, in, you know, each RJ45 should be pretty good. But when you start getting these really high-speed systems, you know, you start and you really want to get the EMI down below 20 dB microvolts, you got to make sure you're using, you know, shell-grounded connectors on your RJ45s. They're actually, they have like special decoupling filters, common mode filters that are built inside these RJ45s. They are grounded to, you know, to shielded grounds that go around these devices. A lot of these devices you'll pick up and you'll see they're plastic cases on the outside. And then you'll find all kinds of metal shielding inside these boxes and everything else going around. So, there is grounds that interconnect everything and the shields do interconnect. So, basically what generates the noise is once something picks, in other words, if everything's floating, like you're saying, in other words, each differential pair is both completely isolated with respect to its ground, yes, that's okay, but depending on how each manufacturer produces a device, they might have Y-caps inside, and something's tying something down to a chassis someplace, and all of a sudden it gives it a polarity, and when you plug it into another device, the two devices may not have been tested in an anechoic chamber together. And that's what basically happens. Each one might be running on a resistive load when it's going through its testing. So then when you put all these Y-cap differentials and everything else going in between, it can definitely cause problems.
Interesting. Over to you, Alex.
Yeah. First of all, I said I have a single gentle reminder, but in between they accumulated four. And the first one now that was important is that I'm listening on 375 because the local repeater here is very active and I can't listen to the 250. To the 850. But once I listen to 35, it's through 375, it's impossible to get into the net anymore because of the audio delay. I do not know when other people have finished and I'm coming in on top of everybody else. So I really apologize if that's happening, but just to let you know, Dick, I think you know. Now, the initial gentle reminder is that we have not to forget, we're talking about the tours in the wire, that the impedance of the wire, the two wires, depends on the number of turns per inch. So the tighter the turns per inch are, the a different impedance is in that two wires. So this is means to control the impedance of the two wires, so they will not actually be on the same impedance as the other ones. If they are truly, I never looked at that, but I will look tomorrow, if they are truly different turns on the wires. This will be highly unusual, but the impedance of the wire depends also on the very strongly about the number of turns on the wire. We cannot use CMR, Dick, because CMR is good only for parallel wires. If you start to turn the wire and you start to add all that crap that Glenn actually mentions, the CMR is going down the drain. There is no CMR to speak of in internet. And the third one is, I really want to reiterate that there are two types of hubs. Well, two types of connection to the internet network. One, it is a passive hub where it is the wireless is simply spliced with controlled impedance connectors and whatnot. And that one is the repeater that actually regenerates the amplitude and the quality of the signal. This is why I said over 200 feet in all of the good installations, you use repeaters rather than hubs. That means that system administrator will not have so many headaches. Back to you, Dick.
I just went and listened to the 375 machine. First flip from 85 and then over to 375, and I realized that the total time delay right now is approximately 4 or 5 seconds. The particular internet line it picks up sometimes is very brief, like a third of a second, and sometimes it's very long, like 5 seconds. Unfortunately, you're in the 5 second category right now, which means if we don't drop the repeater for 5 seconds, you won't be able to get back to us. Now, from your and my microwave background, Alex, we know that we make ourselves a microwave gimmick capacitor by taking two wires and twisting them together, that as you twist the wires more and more, you develop more and more gimmick capacitance. That's true. However, we're developing more capacitance for two reasons. One, when we twist them more and more, the two wires are being brought closer together. That's the minor factor. The major factor is that when we twist the two wires, a longer length of wire is in the twisted mode, and the two are adjacent to each other. Therefore, we build up capacitance. Now, the next time you've got a piece of Cat5 cable in your hand, and you look at it carefully, you will, without a doubt, see that there are four different twist rates. However, each of those twisted wires have the exact same spacing between them, whether it's a slightly tighter twist or a slightly looser twist, the exact same spacing, essentially no airspace between the wires. The separation between the wires, if you take a slice of any of those four data pairs, you'll see that the spacing between the two wires is essentially the same. I personally have carefully measured the impedance of each of those four twisted pairs. I could not resolve a difference in impedance. They were extremely close to 100 ohms, plus or minus 5, each of the four pairs. So when you have a gentle twist rate of wires that are truly parallel, whether it's a slightly tighter twist or a slightly looser twist, you've got the exact same impedance.
I give you the twist rate.
Go right ahead.
All right. I got a chart here. The twist rate, you want it in centimeters or meters?
Centimeters.
All right, the green pair is 1.53 centimeters turn. The blue pair is 1.54 centimeters. The orange pair is 1.78. And the brown pair is 1.94.
Okay, that was green. Blank, orange, and brown. What was the, I should know, what was the second one?
I'm sorry, Dick, I got interrupted, yes.
You gave me four colors. What were the order of the four colors?
Green, blue, orange, and brown.
Okay, 1.53, 1.54, 1.78, and 1.94. Twists per centimeter. Turns per centimeter. That is the Cat5 standard, and I guarantee that those four twist rates give you the exact same impedance and nearly the maximum isolation between adjacent data pairs. So it's very well. There's a lot of sophistication in that very simple-looking piece of cable, that very cheap-looking Cat5 cable, and the Cat5e version with that fancy piece of plastic inside that holds them all together just right. And it also has a higher quality, lower loss tangent kind of plastic. The next thing I did 5 years ago was measuring the dB loss per 10 feet, as I remember, of the twisted pair. And the Cat5e, I thought it was Cat6e, but the E version of the cable, the higher frequency version, had about half the loss per dB per 10 foot, as I remember. And had a much higher integrity at higher frequencies. I presume it's still pretty rare. Glenn, when you do see Cat5e, I think you're saying there's a characteristic marking on the outside of the cable. By the same token, when you see shielded Cat5 cable, is there a characteristic marking or a characteristic color? Without looking very carefully at the model number, would I know on the outside which of those cables I'm looking at? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Just let me add one thing. Cat 7 cable is the one which has each pair individually shielded and then an outside shield for the whole thing.
Okay, that's Cat 7. Is there a Cat 6 cable, to your knowledge?
Yeah, there's a Cat 6 and a Cat 6A. One is actually Cat 6, I believe. Let me look at it right here. Cat 6 is good to 250 megahertz. Cat 6A. There's a whole argument about it. It's 350 megahertz. And then 5E is supposedly
good to 550 megahertz, so go figure.
Okay, if Cat 5e is 550 megahertz, what is ordinary Grut Cat 5 in megahertz? Go ahead.
Is this megahertz or megabits?